Good morning, friends. It's time for Friday with Jim here on Coast Community Radio, and I am your host, Jim Wilkins, ably assisted by our engineer par excellence, Mr. Terry Wilson. Terry, thanks for being with us again on Friday. The Friday show was conceived and manipulated into existence by Lisa Smith, longtime friend of the station. She actually used to be the manager at KMUN. Today we've got a guest by telephone. Usually we do these interviews live, but we'll be talking by telephone with Chris Phillips, who is the managing editor of Fisherman's News, and he comes to us live from Seattle. Chris, are you with us?
Thank you, Jim. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. Now, I'd like to start out, Chris, if you could tell us a little bit about your about yourself. Where did you grow up, go to school, and how did you end up being a journalist with a kind of a particular interest in the fisheries?
Well, I grew up in a suburb of Seattle. I'm a fourth-generation Seattleite. My father was the editor of Fisherman's News from the early 70s to the late 80s with his partner, who was the publisher. My dad went his separate ways and started his own magazine. My brother and I joined the magazine to work for my dad, who passed away in 99. And his former partner with Fisherman's News in 2000 wanted to retire and offered to sell the magazine to us. So we bought it, my brother and I, and he's the publisher. I'm the managing editor. And it's one of those things that I've really been doing all my life. When I was 7 years old, I was stuffing envelopes and standing at trade shows and handing out copies of the Fisherman's News to fishermen and equipment suppliers. So it's in my blood, and my father was a journalist, and I kind of learned at his knee. So it feels like I've grown up doing this, even though I've only been the managing editor for 15 years.
Have you ever done any actual commercial fishing?
No, I have not done any commercial fishing. I worked on a processor when I was a kid, but I worked in a blast freezer, which I wouldn't recommend to anyone, other than the fact that it's good money. I also worked on the deck of a tender in Alaska, which was great money and not very much work. But other than that, no, I haven't done any commercial fishing.
Now, the Fisherman's News has been around for a while and fairly limited distribution. I know that in the Astoria area, one can find the Fisherman's News at England Marine. If somebody was interested in the publication, how would they go about getting it?
Well, we're a trade publication, and as such, we're audited by a third party to make sure that we're sending the magazine to the people we say we are. For example, if you're a butcher in Wichita, an engine supplier isn't interested in reaching you with his ad. So we only send it to fishermen. Now, if you're a commercial fisherman, you can go to fishermansnews.com, and there's a free trial offer that you can sign up for and get the magazine to see if it's something that would fit your needs. But as I say, the reason we're a limited distribution, our circulation is about 4,800, and that's because we only reach commercial fishermen along the West Coast from San Diego to Alaska.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, Astoria is historically a fishing village, and the whole town is kind of interested in fishing, but of course not everybody is a commercial fisherman. Now, if somebody, just a civilian, for example, wanted to get the Fisherman's News, could one subscribe to it without being a commercial fisherman?
Yes, but we would probably charge him more than he wanted to pay. We really, it is a, well, you know, we're audited.
Okay.
It costs us money to serve somebody that's not serving us. So we have to print it, we have to mail it, we have to pay the writers. There's a lot of overhead that's not covered by the subscription price. So if you are not going to buy something from one of our advertisers, frankly, we're just not interested in reaching you. So if you want to reach it, you want to read it as a dilettante, I think we charge $100 a year for it. So we're happy to serve you as somebody who has an interest in the publication. But if you're not a commercial fisherman, we're just not interested.
Do you distribute the publication to the tribes?
We distribute it to any commercial fisherman that wants to get it. We have a lot of tribal readers, and we have contributors from the tribes. We don't differentiate. I mean, the commercial fishermen all use the same gear. You know, whether you're a tribal fisherman or a non-tribal fisherman, if you need a new engine, you have to go to an engine supplier, or you need a you know, you need your net mended, or if you need new gear, new deck machinery, they're all buying from the same suppliers.
Right.
Excuse me.
Now, recently an Oregon fisherman was found guilty in federal court of interfering with apparently an observer on a commercial boat. Can you tell that story to us?
Well, he was not found guilty. He was acquitted. The case was dismissed almost immediately.
Okay. What was the basis of the case?
Beg your pardon?
What was the basis of the original case?
Well, the National Marine Fisheries Service puts observers on vessels, and their observers are there to make sure that the rules that are put in place by the National Marine Fisheries Service are observed by the fishermen. These observers are not necessarily commercial mariners or fishermen. They are most often scientists, biologists, young people getting started in the industry. And in this instance, this is kind of a he said, he said. So I won't. A lot of this is conjecture, but the facts are that the observer accused the fisherman of poking him in the shoulder. The observer called the police, had him arrested for assault, and he was basically shorebound for 7 months while he waited for the case to come to trial.
Wow.
The case came to trial, and the judge threw it out. He said, basically, there's nothing here, and now the fisherman is back at work. Nobody really knows enough about the case to speculate who was right and who was wrong. I think it's tough. Now, he says that there was a problem. They were landing a 20-pound halibut, and the observer was in danger. That there was a safety issue, and the deck boss, the fisherman, had warned the observer, and the observer was in the way.
Right.
And so the fisherman may have raised his voice, poked the observer with a finger. I don't know if that rises to the level of assault. Apparently, the judge didn't feel that.
Well, it sounds like an interesting story.
Well, you know, and let me just point out that we've all heard of the deadliest catch, which focuses on crab fishing in Alaska. That is not the deadliest catch. The deadliest catch is actually West Coast salmon. It's much more dangerous to troll or seine for salmon off the coast of Washington or Oregon than it is to fish for crab in Alaska. And it's extremely dangerous, and halibut as well. Anytime you're on the deck of a commercial vessel, whether it be a fishing boat or a tugboat, it's a dangerous atmosphere. And if you don't know what you're doing, you can get extremely badly injured or killed. And when they call the guy a deck boss for a reason, he's there to make sure that the fish come in and that nobody gets hurt.
Well, it sounds to me like it's dangerous because you've got people on board that maybe are unfamiliar with the risks involved in what they're doing, these observers, and you don't see that in the Bering Sea. I mean, if you're on the Bering Sea, if you don't know what you're doing, you shouldn't be there.
Well, you've got observers up there, too. The thing is this. The observers are trained in first aid. They're trained in conflict resolution. And they're trained on how to recognize harassment. That's what the National Marine Fisheries Service puts in their quiver when they put them on a boat. First aid, conflict resolution, and how to recognize harassment. So you kind of start out with one strike against you. When you're a fisherman, you've got an observer on your boat. The observer is there to look over your shoulder. He doesn't necessarily know anything about commercial fishing. All
right.
He knows is what he was told.
Yeah. I'm curious about your take on the impacts to the commercial fishery, particularly offshore, of climate change, and how has that affected particularly draggers and trollers that fish offshore?
Well, you know, I'm not a scientist, and even if I were...
I'm not either.
My area of expertise might, you know, my opinion might be different from another scientist who's just as smart as me. The problem with climate change is that nobody's really sure what its effects are, whether the effects that we're seeing are El Nino, La Nina, long-term change in the climate, a short-term spike. The reality is that, I'll start by saying, just so for your listeners, the West Coast U.S. commercial fishery is arguably the best managed fishery in the world. We do not have an overfishing problem on the West Coast. We haven't even come close to that. And one of the reasons is that we err on the side of caution. If the fishery looks like it's going to be taxed, it gets shut down. Now, that said, fish move. Fish are mobile. And if the water is too warm for a fish to be comfortable, he'll go somewhere else. We've seen that with sardines up and down the coast. You know, there was a huge, huge sardine fishery in San Pedro in California in the 50s and 60s, and it disappeared. And, you know, there was an outcry about how they had fished the sardine to extinction. Well, it didn't. They just moved. The temperatures changed, and the fish moved. And that's what I think we're going to find with climate change. Regardless of the causes and regardless of really the effects, the bottom line is that the fish aren't dying. They're just moving. So the fishermen, in order to prosecute the fishery, will just have to find where they went.
Well, halibut, or excuse me, herring and fish like that come and go on a cyclical basis that's
right.
Independent of climate, really. I mean, that's gone
right.
on for thousands of years. So it must be difficult to differentiate between what's causing these cycles. Is it something that's just inherent in the ocean, or is it caused by human-caused climate change?
Well, it's all natural. I mean, the cycles are all natural. In fact, one of the things that my father did when he first started out on his own was publish an annual publication, and he did that in partnership with the Fisherman's News. And it was a publication aimed at the Alaska fisheries, and what they did was he basically just put tables of statistics together, and I remember him working in his office in the study of the house, staying up late at night, typing all these tables out, because they were looking at numbers, catch numbers, and after several years, you can determine these cycles. There's definitely an up and down. And we have the internet now. It's a lot easier to track that, and we have digital spreadsheets, so it's not the same thing, but it's just as easy to track those cycles, and you see that again, regardless of what's causing the changes in the ocean, the fish will adapt. They already have. You know, they move to colder climes. The fish that like warmer climes move to warmer climes. I mean, right now tuna's big. In the North Pacific, the salmon runs this year are going to be particularly good.
Albacore, you mean?
Albacore, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's. We are a blip on the life of the Earth, and for us to presume that we can determine that something we've done has caused this massive resource to drastically change, I think it's pretty self-centered.
Okay. Yeah, I'd like to remind our listeners that it's Friday here at Coast Community Radio, and we're visiting with Chris Phillips, who is the managing editor of Fisherman's News in Seattle. And Chris, we appreciate speaking with you. Now, one of the things I'd like to talk a little bit about now is bycatch. And I'm thinking specifically of drag fishermen that drag their nets across the bottom of the ocean. And actually, they're after groundfish and rockfish and that kind of thing, but they end up catching a lot of different stuff. They bring it up and empty the net onto the boat, and anything that isn't a target of their fishery, they just kind of toss it overboard. Now, to me, that's always seemed like kind of a waste.
They're required by law to toss that overboard.
Exactly.
And it is a waste, and it's there's a reason it's called bycatch. It's a byproduct, and it's. A lot of it is extremely useful fish. Right now, there's a problem with halibut bycatch in the North Pacific, with the directed cod and pollock fisheries, because they have a bycatch allowance that's actually higher than the halibut fishermen's allowance. So they're catching more halibut in bycatch than the actual halibut fishermen are allowed to catch. And that's an issue that's going to be resolved, but it's going to be resolved around a table with a lot of raised voices.
Well, I understand, and that's kind of the point that I'm hoping to get you to speak to, is what kind of dialogue is happening now about reducing the dead fish? I mean, if you've got a big bycatch and you toss it overboard, it's dead. But it's a useful source of protein, and it would seem to me that there would be some kind of dialogue happening about being able to legally use and market that bycatch.
Well, one solution that they've tried with pretty good success in Europe is to harvest that bycatch rather than throwing it back overboard, and attribute the profit from that bycatch to the directed fishery, i.e., if you're out there trawling for bottom fish and you catch salmon, you're required currently to throw that salmon overboard. But rather than doing that, if you process that salmon and sell it and then take the profit from that and give it to the salmon fishery, then everybody wins because the salmon fishermen would have caught those anyway. But it's not as simple as that. There are a lot of issues to be resolved. Processing equipment for halibut is different from processing equipment for pollock, which is different from processing equipment for salmon. And if you're on a trawler that is trawling for one species, you can't necessarily quickly adapt to process a completely different species. So there are issues that have to be resolved. I will say, though, that the trawl industry has really been proactive in developing resources to dramatically reduce bycatch. They have excluders. They have devices to keep the net off the bottom. They have all sorts doors and methods that allow a lot of the bycatch that used to come in to swim away free before it gets caught in the net. Mm-hmm. So they're doing a lot on their end to reduce bycatch, but more needs to be done to, as you say, address what to do with the bycatch. Now, there's a program in Alaska, and I think it may be coast-wide, called Sea Share, where they actually take the bycatch and they donate it to food banks, and that works very well if you can do it. The key is to be able to take that fish and keep it in a saleable or a usable state between the time you take it out of the water and the time you deliver it to wherever you're going to deliver it.
Well, and there's a certain amount of work involved in doing that, and that the bycatch has to be bled and iced down and kept palatable.
Right.
So it's not exactly free because there's a lot of work involved in dealing with it.
Right, right.
Now, another thing I'd like to talk about is I know there's a move afoot in the Washington legislature and also in Oregon that we spoke about earlier, that to kind of eliminate commercial fishing, particularly on the main stem of the Columbia. I'm not familiar with the efforts in the House in Washington in this direction. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Both the House and the Senate have introduced bills to basically close Washington to commercial fishing. The sponsors in the House are bipartisan. You've got Republicans and Democrats, and it's almost 50-50 both in the House and the Senate, saying that the priority should be sport fishing in Washington rather than commercial fishing. And it's misguided because they claim that the sport fishery in Washington, and I'm using Washington as an example because that's what I know best.
Okay.
Oregon and Washington are in the same boat.
Right.
They have the same issues. They have the same problems. The sport fishery in Washington has been decreasing at a rate of 28% per year since 2002. People aren't fishing for sport the way they used to. It's a dirty little secret that the sport fishing industry is trying to sweep under the rug. They have aligned with the CCA, which is a Coastal Conservation Association, which is a, quote, conservation organization that was put together by the oil companies in the Gulf to basically roll over the fishermen in the Gulf. They've now moved up the coast, and it's a concerted effort to stop commercial fishing. The governors of Oregon and Washington are complicit. Their fish commissions have done the same thing. They closed the Columbia River essentially to commercial gill nets. They're trying to do the same thing along the coast. Now, the new governor, Oregon's new governor, Kate Brown, may decide that she wants to reverse that. She may decide that she's going to act on behalf of the residents of Oregon that want to see salmon on their plate, that want to go to a restaurant and order a nice piece of salmon that was locally caught. Washington's governor, I have to tell you, after 2 years, he has not answered one question on this. He has ducked and dodged. He keeps appointing sport fishermen and conservationists to the Fish and Wildlife Commission. It's a concerted effort to just shut it down.
I'm curious, Chris, about the motivation behind that effort. What's driving the sport fishermen to do that? Do they think that there'll be more salmon for them, or I'm not quite getting it?
Well, I can't speak to the motivation of the sport fishermen. All I can speak to is the motivation of politicians, and that comes down to campaign contributions. The sport fishing lobby is big and has deep pockets. The conservation lobby is also big and has deep pockets. Between the two, as they're allied, they can go to these politicians and say, hey, we're going to support your campaign. In return, you support us. The commercial fishing lobby is non-existent. There is no commercial fishing lobby. As I discussed, our circulation, you know, our universe of commercial fishermen on the West Coast is probably 6,000. Now, they bring in billions, with a B, of dollars in profits that are shared among all the consumers and all the taxing authorities on the West Coast. But they don't have this massive lobby. While a good example, the seafood industry in 2014 generated $8 billion in sales impacts in Washington State. $8 billion. The sport fish industry that they're promoting generated $514 million that same year. So the sport fisheries that they think should be a priority, the ratio is 16 to 1. They want to close the commercial fishery that brings $8 billion to the state and promote the sport fishery that brings in $514 million.
Well, I know you said you're unfamiliar with what's motivating that, but if you had to speculate, what's driving this incredible effort to do away with commercial fishermen who actually provide you and I fish when we go to the store?
Well, honestly, I don't know. The commercial fishermen have always been willing to share the fish with the anglers, with the sport fishermen. There are hatcheries up and down the coast that produce fish to be fished by the tribes, the commercial fishermen, and the sport fishermen. The efforts. Now, I don't know if it's a sport, and let me say that.
I'm asking you to speculate.
It's the lobbies. It's the equipment suppliers. It's the people like Cabela's and Walmart's that support these lobbies.
Well, that's, yeah, okay, that's kind of what I was hoping to get you head in that direction.
Yeah.
But, again, I'm still not sure what's motivating Cabela's, for example, to spend the amount of effort and spend the amount of money. Do they actually think that more fish will be available to them?
Well, I don't know if it's that more fish will be. Well, maybe so. You know, there are fisheries that are closed to the sport fishery so that the commercial fishery can prosecute them. Maybe they just want to be able to fish anywhere they want, anytime they want. Lures get lost. You got to buy new ones. So Gamakatsu, which is a Japanese company, sells more lures. Now, the money they get from those lures goes back to Japan. Cabela's, I think, is a main company. Walmart, I'm not sure where they're. I think they're in the Midwest somewhere.
Benton,
the people
Arkansas.
That sell commercial fishing gear. What's that? I'm sorry?
Arkansas,
fair enough. The people that sell fishing nets, man, we're talking, you know, $5, $10, $20,000 worth of net.
Yeah.
Build them here in Washington. They build them right there on the Columbia. So when you close the Columbia to gill netting, those net manufacturers are leaving, and they're not going to stick around and serve the tribes. They'd like to, but the tribes can't buy enough net from them to keep them open. Same with the engine suppliers, the deck equipment suppliers, anybody that serves the commercial fishing industry on the Washington or Oregon coast is going to have to go somewhere else. And they're going to take their expertise with them. The tribes will not be able to, they won't be able to continue fishing without people to fix their engines or build their nets or build the deck equipment. It's going to be, it'll be like just like the spotted owl. It's going to, the lumber industry on Washington's coast basically closed overnight. The same thing's going to happen to the commercial fishing industry, and it's at the behest of Washington and Oregon legislators. And I have to be very clear on that. Your legislator wants to close the commercial fishery.
Well, that's true. They want to, in Oregon, for example, ex-Governor Kitzhaber wanted and proposed closing the main stem of the Columbia River to gill nets, which provided a lot of fish for people to eat. But I don't see what will fill that market niche if you eliminate commercial fisheries. In other words, there won't be as many fish available at Fred Meyer's, for example. Am I correct?
Well, there won't be any unless you buy it frozen from Alaska. But now let's be clear that the same parties that are trying to close the fisheries in Washington and Oregon are closing them in Alaska. They've already tried to shut down the set net fisheries, the gillnet fisheries in Cook Inlet and in Bristol Bay. So it's coast-wide. But for the time being, if they close Washington and Oregon, you'll get your salmon frozen from Alaska. Unfortunately, it may very well be that you get your salmon frozen from China or from Russia, because the Chinese and the Russians are still prosecuting the fishery.
Or from
and
Chile.
They're catching the same salmon over there.
Hmm. Okay. We just got a couple of minutes left, Chris. I'm wondering whether you had any final words for our listeners here at Coast Community Radio.
Well, I'd like to remind them that if they like a nice piece of salmon or a nice piece of halibut in a restaurant somewhere, that was purchased from a commercial fisherman. It was probably not purchased from a processor. It was purchased right off the boat. It was probably fresh that morning. That's going to go away. You can't catch enough fish with a rod and reel to keep the restaurants in Portland and Seattle and Astoria in seafood.
So we'd see an influx of farmed fish, I suppose.
If you want to eat farmed fish, you might as well just unwrap a Twinkie, because it's pretty much the same ingredient.
Well, Chris Phillips, really appreciate you speaking with us. It's time to bring the interview to a close, and thanks again, Chris. And I appreciate what you're doing. And as a resident of a very strong fishing little village here in Astoria, we really thank you.
Well, my pleasure, Jim. Thank you for having me on.
Great. I'd invite our listeners to stick around Coast Community Radio for a little bit of headline news, followed by Albert Smith. And as always, really wonderful Friday folk show. Thanks for being with us, and I'll talk to you again next Friday with Jim.